Welcome to the iCoder podcast with Ian McDuff.
Hello once again, dear listeners, and welcome to this iCoder podcast. I'm Ian McDuff, and I'm your host for the series. And as always, I speak with you from Wellington in Aotearoa, New Zealand. In this conversation, I'm delighted to be joined by my colleague and fellow member of the global ODR community, Daniel Rainey. Daniel is the principal in Holistic Solutions Incorporated, HSI, and an adjunct faculty member in graduate dispute resolution programs and law schools. He's a fellow of the National Center for Technology and Dispute Resolution, a member of the board of directors for the internetbar.org, and a founding member and founding board member and chair of the governance committee of ICODA, the International Council for Online Dispute Resolution. Daniel has served as the co-chair of the Working Group 3 for the ODR Task Force, the American Bar Association section of dispute resolution, and co-chair of the International Mediation Institute's Online Mediator Competency Task Force. You're a busy boy, Daniel. He was one of the instructors for the first university ODR course at UMass in Amherst, and with Colin Rule, whose name keeps popping up in all these podcasts, designed and taught the first ODR course required in a graduate dispute resolution program at Creighton University. He's developed graduate level ODR courses for several universities, in addition to skills-based ODR training for dispute resolution centers and professional associations. As a consultant, he's worked with clients in the development of ODR resources, intercultural negotiation skills, ombudsman programs, organizational conflict engagement programs in public, private, and nonprofit sectors. In the writing world, he's one of the editors in chief of the International Journal of Online Dispute Resolution, and is also author editor of the splendid and award-winning book, Online Dispute Resolution Theory and Practice, which I would highly recommend as a text people should have on their shelves. Second edition came out in 2021. He's author of the recently released Integrating Technology into Your Dispute Resolution Practice, and many other book chapters and papers. And I want to return, Daniel, to that book. In September 2017, he retired as the Chief of Staff for the National Mediation Board, and October 2017, at the Association for Conflict Resolution Annual Conference, he received the Mary Parker Follett Award for Innovation in Dispute Resolution. And anyone who's been around this field for a while will know that Mary Parker Follett from the 1920s, I think, was it, Ben?
Yeah, 1930s.
One of our real pioneers in the field. And often an unsung pioneer. So welcome to this podcast series, Dan, and thank you for taking the time to join us.
Oh, I'm delighted to be with you. I'm hoping we have a good conversation.
I've no doubt we will. Bit of background, and the background provided by you. How did you get into this field? How did you move into thinking about and working in the field of applying technology to traditional ADR practices, as distinct from, say, e-commerce or the courts?
It's my my path into this was a little bit different from some of the other people you may have talked to. For Colin and Ethan, for example, I had actually forgotten the initial foray into what I would call ODR until a colleague of mine mentioned it to me several years ago, and it was, oh yeah, we did that. We did a mediation between North Africa, London, and Washington, D.C. using telephones and fax machines back in the late 1980s. I don't know if some people would call that ODR or not, but it was my first foray into using technology. And really, my entry into thinking about this in a sort of systematized way came in the mid-1990s when I was hired by the National Mediation Board as a consultant. They were looking for someone who knew something about technology, but also knew something about mediation and ADR. And at the time, we were rather thin on the ground. And so I started working with them, and their interest was a very mundane interest. That is, they had mediators who were on the road 3 weeks a month, working all over the country and working remotely, and they wanted to find a way to have those people have the ability to work from anywhere and to have access to the information that they needed to mediate very complicated labor disputes, very high dollar labor disputes. And so I started working with the National Mediation Board to put together an online a library, I suppose you would call it, a way for them to access information that normally they would have either had to come back to the office for or would have had to carry, you know, mountains of paper. And that doesn't sound very revolutionary, but for those folks, it was extremely revolutionary. It was a way to begin to use the technology that was available to do the job that they did in a much more effective way. And so that's how I really got into it. And when we really began thinking about it in terms of ODR, when I did, in the early 2000s, I met Colin and I met Ethan Katch and Leah Wing and Alan Gatenby, who were at UMass Amherst. And together with the National Mediation Board, UMass Amherst and the board put together a proposal for the National Science Foundation. And basically it was to study the impact of technology on mediation. And so we spent from 2004 to 2010 doing a series of development projects and experimental projects to basically answer that question. You know, what difference does it make that you use technology to do this work? We focused essentially on I would say two things. One is, if we're using the technology and you're doing this remotely, do you feel that you are being heard and you're being treated fairly in the same way that you would be if you were face to face? And the answer to that was yes. And the other thing was, what are some of the unique things that you can do with the technology that you can't do using face-to-face methods? And we really focus more on anonymity, the possibility of anonymous input and increasing input and increasing the type of input using technology. So we ran that research from 2004 to 2010. And that was, I guess, when I really became involved with Ethan and Colin and the other folks who were doing ODR work, although what they were doing for the most part was in the e-commerce world and later integrating into the court systems. And my focus has been from the very beginning, what does all of this technology stuff mean to a practitioner, somebody who's doing relatively traditional ADR work, mediation, arbitration, facilitation, et cetera? What difference does it make to them? And how should they be doing this in a way that is effective? And that's really been my focus, as opposed to the e-commerce world that Colin has been in for most of his career.
Magus, what I'm enjoying about your background explanation there is the sense that when we talk about ODR, both historically and in contemporary terms, we're talking about a spectrum from relatively straightforward use and application of technology in the ways in which you've discussed it, through to the more exotic, almost the more technology driven. So we range from the technology facilitated to the technology centered. And yours, if I understand you correctly, is a question of how technology can help us do our job, particularly if we're out on the road and have no other means of communication. So if you were thinking about the field, the term ODR, my guess is you have a very inclusive definition, an inclusive sense of what ODR is.
I think that would be fair to say. I respect the definitions that are coming from the other side, so to speak, where they're talking about the need to do all the work online and to integrate artificial intelligence, et cetera, which, by the way, we can talk about later. I think that's coming even for private practitioners, but that's another story. Yep. But for me, I have a very simple definition of online dispute resolution that I had in my own mind very early on, and it has not really changed. And that is that if you're using technology, information and communication technology, to fulfill any of the primary functions that you do as a third party, then you belong in the ODR tent. Ethan's term, the fourth party, is one that stuck with me very early on, that when you add technology, even in a very simple way, you are changing the dynamic of the work that you do. And the example that I've used over and over that I use in the book is that when we started using computers off the internet, just a desktop computer to keep notes and to organize information as we were working with parties primarily face-to-face, that changed the way we could talk about what we do. If I'm operating face-to-face and I'm using primarily paper, when I get to the end of a mediation, I can shred that paper and I can say to the parties, I will not unless forced to do so by the law, I will not reveal any information and I will not compromise your information based on our interaction. When I start using technology, it's harder for me to say that because unless I pull the hard drive out of my computer and physically destroy it, probably can be brought back. It can probably be through forensics, probably be revealed. Yeah. If I move forward another half step and say I'm putting this in the cloud anywhere, then my ability to categorically say your information is completely protected is in my mind gone. And that makes a difference. And I think the difference that it makes mostly for me is a difference in ethical responsibility on the part of the third party. I should understand that, and I should be able to tell that to the parties I'm working with in a way that allows them to enter into work with me, knowing what the risks are and knowing what the advantages are, and being able to say with full self-determination, yes, I'll buy the risk because I want the advantage. Sure. But I think it's ethically imperative that I be able to do that in a way they understand. And you know, that's just with any of the technology that I use. It doesn't have to be artificial intelligence, and it doesn't have to be all online. It's when I inject that technology into the work that I do, I am injecting something new, a fourth party, into that process. Mm-hmm. And I think in my mind, I better be prepared to understand it and be able to tell the parties about it in a way that makes sense.
So very nice. So practical combination there in your comments, Dan, of the practical components. You mean you could, in front of your clients, say, look at me, I'm deleting this file from my hard drive, my phone, or whatever. But we all know that it's not deleted. It's right. Never gone. Some clever person can find that. But the bit that resonates with me and probably with people like Leah Wing is that this has a very powerful ethical component to it as well. It obliges us to think again about how we're working in this realm. It's not simply a matter of doing the same work with a little bit of technology added. It actually changes what we're doing.
Absolutely. And yeah. One of the things that I use as sort of a centerpiece of that when we're talking about this kind of thing in the training and the education that I do, is I talk about doing a risk damage assessment with the parties. And so I look at what is the risk, if I'm using a certain technology, what is the risk that the information I'm using with the parties is going to be inadvertently or inappropriately distributed?
Yep.
And then on the other side of that equation is the damage. If it is, in fact, inappropriately shared, what's the damage that occurs? And so if the damage, you know, if you don't care if you see it on the front page of the newspaper tomorrow, then the damage is relatively small. And I don't worry so much about the risk. I might even be able to use, you know, simple email. Mm-hmm. But if the risk is high, which, for example, in email, it obviously is, because we've all made mistakes about where we send stuff and with email. If the risk is high and the damage is great, then I better think about another technology to use. And there's some work that I've done where we've basically said, we don't want to put any of it online. We're going to actually send a messenger across town and send hard copy because the risk is so high if it gets out that we really don't want it. It would be inappropriate to use online technology. So that sort of risk damage assessment to me is sort of a fundamental ethical process that I use in my own mind to say, okay, we're either going to use this technology or that technology or no technology to work with the information that the parties feel is central to their issue.
Which it makes me think of the work that our Sri Lankan colleague Sanjana Hatatua has been involved in. He's now based in New Zealand and yeah. working on disinformation projects. But when he was in Sri Lanka, amongst the examples he would use, and we've had this in our own experience in Sri Lanka and elsewhere, is that when you talk about risk, it's not just risk of reputational damage, it's risk of staying alive.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's really vital to be aware of those consequences for some people. If the information gets out there, they're not likely to survive the rest of the day.
Yeah, and that's the extreme, and sort of moving in that direction with the kind of work that I did with the board is we had proprietary information, proprietary financial information for, you know, Fortune 50 companies that they really did not want to hit the street. And so, you know, you have to be very careful. It wasn't going to kill anybody if it was inappropriately handled, but it certainly was going to make some interesting times for the parties who were involved. Yeah.
Well, even in the fairly simple and now very familiar context of folks using Zoom, such as we are, There has to be a question, can I be confident that actually there's nobody else in the room with you?
Right.
You know, because I'm lucky I've got you on screen here, but I don't know, you don't know if there's someone tucked around the outside of the door there. And so issues of trust and communication ethics become that much more important. I mean, this is, you know, when I had a conversation with Leah Wing a few weeks back, and as you'll know, she focuses on the ethics issues. But what your comments so far have done is highlight for me the very straightforward, practical use of technology, migrating, you know, or connecting that to ADR practice, is also intimately bound up with ethical issues. And I think this, yeah. You know, if I could take a yellow highlighter on our audio and mark that, I would in some way. But I think it's very important that you raise that. But a question, you've been around this field for quite some time, shall I say, as one of the pioneers of this field. What's changed in the last, say, five years or so? What changes have you seen that change your kind of practice, or have caused you to sit back and think about the field?
I think the biggest changes I've seen, pardon me, are twofold. One is in the kind of technology that's available for private practitioners. And second, the degree to which either artificial intelligence, although you have to be very careful how you define that, but augmented intelligence maybe is a better way to put it, mm-hmm. is moving its way into the private practitioner field. For most of the time that we've been dealing with the notion of ODR, essentially, if you were a mediator, arbitrator, facilitator, et cetera, you probably had to create this mosaic of technology that would do the things you needed it to do. So there really wasn't a lot of technology that was created to do dispute resolution. But you could find web video, you could find document sharing, you could find ways to do joint editing online, that sort of thing. So all these things were out there, but you probably had to sort of cobble them together in sort of a virtual space that you created for your parties, because there really wasn't a lot of technology that was created end to end to do dispute resolution.
Yep.
Over the last few years, that's begun to change a lot. I think you spoke with Graham, I think, in this series before. Graham created the mediation room back in the early 2000s, a perfectly good technology, probably half a decade at least ahead of its time. In order to use technology like that, you have to have enough people who are willing to use it, both on the practitioner side and the party side. And he was very early in the game. But once that's not on the, you know, on the board, it wasn't a whole lot other than, again, sort of cobbling together this mosaic of stuff that you could use. But in the last few years, that's begun to change quite a bit in two ways. One is you're beginning to have very focused technology that does a venue, a piece of the work that we do. So if you in divorce mediation, you can probably find a way to have technology that will help you work through the financial issues of separating property. Those kind of technologies, those kind of platforms are coming up all over the place. And you're beginning to get, for example, with mediate.com, what Colin's doing is a cradle-to-grave ADR system that is ODR. It's all online. You can walk in the front door with your input from your parties. You can do all of the things that you have to do in terms of working with the parties all the way to the end of signing an agreement. And that's very well designed, very well thought out software that was not on the market. Hard to find that just a few years ago. So for me, that's a huge difference. And so now you've got choices that you didn't have before if you're doing this work. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that I think is changing, that I think is exciting and frightening, is the specter of artificial intelligence that's on the horizon for the kind of work that is done by, you know, lawyers and arbitrators and mediators. And I've cautioned against this a bit, because some of the earlier attempts to use AI were black box technology, so that you didn't really know what the what the programming looked like that was making the decisions that you're making the recommendations that you're relying on. That's changing. And so I'm not so much worried about that, because we're beginning to get AI that's open source, that you know, you clearly can see how it's programmed. And so I don't worry so much about that anymore. But what I do worry about is that it doesn't really matter how good the AI programming is, the data set that you use is what makes the difference. And so if I have a lousy data set, or if I have a small data set, and I've got good AI programming, but I've got a small data set, I still may get very biased and very incomplete or very skewed recommendations out of the AI. And so I think as a field, one of the things that I keep saying to people over and over again is be loud. Raise your voice, talk about what the stuff needs to do, talk about what the ethical implications are, talk about how we gather information and use the information that drives the AI, because it's coming, it's going to be there, we're going to have it to use. If it's there, people will use it. And the question for me is, are we being loud enough? Are we being enough of a voice as a profession to guide the development of that AI in a way that is truly useful and not going to cause problems, which some of the AI that's been used in the court systems has caused?
I guess that means a key question picks up from your ethics question, which is the accountability one. And who in the end is accountable for what is in the AI box, whether it's a black one or not, and for the data sets and so on. And you're being loud is another way of saying you have to keep in control, I suppose. You stay in charge of your information.
Yeah, or at least talk to the people who are the developers.
Yeah.
And because, you know, one of the problems is not as big a problem as it used to be, but at one point when we were cobbling together these things that were not created for dispute resolution at all, the technology was being created by people who didn't really understand what we do and didn't really understand the implications of the way we operate. And right. So if you have people who are developing artificial intelligence systems that are going to be thrust into dispute resolution, what you want at a minimum is to talk to the people who are creating that technology to let them know what's important to us and what we want to do and what we don't want to do. And so that as they're building the technology, they're at least aware of the things that really drive the profession, that are the baseline of the things that we think are appropriate.
Mm-hmm. There's another kind of couple of linked thoughts here, Mark. I'd love to get onto your book in just a second, but one of the threads through all these conversations I've had is that ODR is a key component in access to justice. And that's a large part of what you've been talking about too, is how we use the technology. There's a parallel question which some of my conversational partners have raised too, which is the access to the technology.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know, I occasionally have dealings with people in a slightly older community who have their iPads or their tablets or their phones, but really are not top-notch users. And I have an anxiety, albeit you know, part of this ODR community, that we might create these mesmerizingly powerful and fascinating technologies which are inaccessible to a lot of folks. And thinking of our namesake, there's a movie which I always recommend, I Daniel Blake. It's an English movie from probably a decade ago now, one of those gritty northern movies, but it's about an unemployed man in his 50s who is on welfare, can't find work, and he's always told, well, all you need to do is to go online and get your benefits. And of course, none of this means anything to him. And he eventually finds his way in the movie to a library where there is a computer where he can go online to obtain his benefits. But of course, he has absolutely no idea. And he also doesn't have the online ID that will allow him to do these things. So is it a concern of yours that while we're doing these very clever things with technology, we're also creating risks for some part of the population?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's still the case that for some people, going online means to going standing behind other people and waiting to get to a window somewhere.
Exactly.
But yeah, it does. And, you know, the idea of access to justice being increased by the use of technology is noble. And I think it is possible and it has happened. But from my point of view, as a, you know, watching the notion of access, the fact that we create good technology does not mean people will go there. Yep. I mean, in the United States, as an example, the Bar Association's estimate is that about 70% of justiciable cases never even reach a lawyer, much less the courts. So that most people who have an issue that could be handled by the justice system never even come close to the justice system. And there are lots of reasons for that. Some of them are economic, some of them are social. But the fact that I build beautiful technology means that the people who would be in the system anyway have a lot better access. It does not mean that people who would not be in the system now suddenly have access, unless we do something other than just create the technology. There's that human touch that I think you have to go out and say to people, it's there. I have a colleague I worked with years ago who was Black, who grew up in the South. And he had a great story that he told when we were teaching together about what has to happen to make people use things that are available. He said that when he was growing up, there was a laundry in the town where he lived that was whites only. And he went back, you know, he went away. He was quite successful. He was a vice president of a company, and et cetera. He came back and he walked down the street. And he walked by that laundry and it had a sign in the sign that had been in the window was no longer there. There was no longer a whites only sign. And his point was, you've got to do a lot more than take the sign down to get me to come in. You have to make sure I understand that I'm welcome. And I think for access to justice, I think the same thing applies. You don't just have to build the technology that makes it easy to get in. You have to make it sure that people understand that there's a reason for them to get in, because many people are not in that position. There are many reasons why they don't approach the justice system. The whole notion of access is a really complicated one. And, you know, on a very basic level, access means, you know, literally, do I have a computer? Can I get there? But, you know, I think if you talk to Leah, you probably got some of this also, is that, you know, once I'm there, how does it treat me? And, you know, is it easy for me to use? Do I understand the implications of its use? Are there things that are happening behind the scenes that I don't know about that affect me, that I ought to know about? So access is it's a multifaceted thing. And I think, again, very important. I've been doing some work over the last few years on a universal protocol for mediation, for describing what we do as mediators to parties. And part of that is driven by the fact that perhaps the thing that is closest to being universal, put it that way, in all of the types of mediation that are out there, and there are at least, you know, 40 or 50 different identifiable types. But one of the things that is almost universal is the notion of self-determination, that the parties get into it knowing what they're doing, they do it willingly, and, you know, they're there because they want to be there. And, you know, we don't want to sell them a bad used car. We want to be able to bring them in and let them know what it looks like to be in that system, in that process, to understand what's happening to them and to do it with self-determination. And access is a huge part of that.
Yeah. I mean, that takes us back again to one of the things that iCoder is working on, which are those sort of core principles of ODR, sure. and transparency, openness, accessibility, and self-determination are absolutely vital. Now, in the interest of time as well, I think, can I move on to something more recent, which is your book, Dan, Integrating Technology into Your Dispute Resolution Practice. I've not yet had a chance to see or get hold of this, but I will certainly do so. Tell me a bit about the book, what your aims in writing that book, because this, I gather from the blurbs I've read about this, this is not the same as other books on ODR. I'll leave it to you to tell us what the book is aimed to do.
Yeah, if you look at the theory and practice book, yep. It's you know, 600 pages of very sometimes academic, sometimes practical things, but it's mostly theoretical. It's if you pick that book up, if you were a mediator and you pick that book up, it wouldn't tell you how to mediate. it would tell you a lot of other stuff. And it's I'm quite proud of the work that we did on that book. But what I tried to do with this recent book, first of all, it's a lot shorter. You can read it actually in one sitting if you want. Yeah. But what I tried to do was say, okay, if you're going to do third-party work as an individual, if you're a lawyer, if you're a mediator, if you're an arbitrator, and you're going to do this work using technology, what should you know? And what are some of the things that would be helpful to you to make you able to do this work better and work with your clients in a way that I think is more ethical? And so basically what I tried to do was I put in at the beginning of the book some observations about, first of all, about the brain and why we do what we do as mediators, and why is it we take the approach that we take, and what difference does it make that the technology is being used to work with parties? How do they perceive the threat? How do they perceive advantage? That sort of thing. So working with some of my colleagues who are into neurobiology, talking a little bit about how the brain operates and what difference that makes if you're operating in technology. Mm-hmm. There's a chapter on culture. What difference does it make culturally if you're operating using technology? What are some of the things that are important to know? And so I try to set up in the beginning a little bit of theoretical approach that says, look, the technology does make a difference in all these things. It's not that we're using technology it's not that the technology is driving all of this, but it's in the background. It's the basis. If we're using it as the channel of communication, then that channel of communication makes a difference. And in fact, there's a whole chapter on communication. And I go all the way back to Claude Shannon, whom you may or may not know. Claude Shannon was a mathematician who worked on communication theory. He wrote a book called The Mathematical Theory of Communication in the late 40s, early 50s, that is the basis of digital communication, essentially. And one of his things was the channel matters. The channel that you use to communicate does, in fact, make a difference in how you communicate. Just mm-hmm. a very basic idea. And what I try to do is take that idea and explain what that means for using technology to do mediation and arbitration and other things. And then the last part of the book is basically, okay, what are the questions you ought to be asking about how you choose technology? What are the questions you ought to be asking about how you approach the parties and pick which of those technology you use with this particular party? What are the questions you ought to be asking about the process that you're presenting to the parties? And so it's a very practical, very nuts and bolts. I tried to answer the question, if I'm a mediator who has to use this stuff, how do I do it well? One of my colleagues said during the pandemic, she said, you know, COVID has made us all start to use technology. Now what we have to do is figure out how to use it well.
Exactly. And just even as you're making those comments, I was thinking it's the kind of book which ought to be written as well for university faculty or school teachers who found themselves having to use the technology, but without the opportunity to sit back and think, well, in what way is technology going to change what it is I'm going to be doing? Quite apart from the issues of access, which take us back to our early part of the conversation. So who's your audience for this book, apart from me, because I'm going to rush it by.
I was writing it for people who generally have not been thought about as being part of the ODR community.
Okay.
And maybe that's a little unfair, but it seems to me that what we've developed over the last 10 to 15 years is an assumption on the part of many people that what we mean by ODR is the e-commerce world where there's sort of cradle to grave online with AI involved, or the e-justice work that's being done now, which is really quite parallel to the e-commerce. In fact, it's where a lot of the technology was born. So those are parts of the ODR field that are sort of separated from the private practitioner. Even though those are very important, there are tons of money that flows through there. It's very important in the justice system. I think most of the people who do dispute resolution don't exist in those two worlds. They exist in law firms, they exist in consulting firms, they exist in community mediation centers and all sorts of other places where people are sitting down trying to work out problems. And those are different environments than e-commerce and the justice system. And the people who do that kind of work, that was my audience.
Yeah. In a sense, much more regular folks than the glossy boardroom stuff that we might be usually thinking about.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah, well, I'm certainly going to head online as you do and go and find myself a copy. It's not something that, as far as I'm aware, has made the bookshelves here. Go to another aspect of your working life, the teaching you do. You've been very much involved in creating courses, mostly at a graduate level, teaching ODR. How do you shape up a course, and what's goes into creating a course which is specifically about ODR and the world that your student body is looking at?
Yeah, you know, that has changed a bit over the years. When Colin and I designed two courses together. One is the graduate course at Southern Methodist University that he taught for a while, that I taught. And we co-designed the first ODR course that was a required course in a graduate program that we know of anywhere. And when we did that, the state of the art at the time, or the state of thinking about ODR at the time, was very much, we want you, sorry about that. I'm here in a hotel room and I don't know who called, no idea. But anyway, what we were trying to do with those courses was to say, look, it is possible to do this work, right? Mm-hmm. Because people would come into the courses thinking, well, you know, the way we do mediation, the way we do, you know, dispute resolution is we sit down together in a room and we have the face-to-face interaction. And so the thrust of what we were trying to do is say, look, the functions that you're involved in doing when you do that work, you can do those things using technology. So it was, I won't say it was a sales job, but it was like, okay, think a little differently about the work that you do. And then what we were trying to do is say, we want you to actually experience working with these technologies. We want to give you a case scenario and let you go out and do it, and then come back and talk about what was different. Mm-hmm. And so it was very, I won't say rudimentary, but it was entering into a group of students who were coming into this with a little bit of skepticism in all likelihood, and who were really lacking a sort of a context. And so we were trying to create a context. That's really different now. You know, when I teach this course now, people come in and say, well, of course you can do this. So the question is, how do I do it well? And so the way we try to frame the course now is not so much, gee, I have to convince you that you can do this. It's more, let's do it and tell me what went wrong and tell me what went right. And let's talk about why it went right and why it went wrong. And I talk much more about the ethics now, especially about the ethics of choosing technology and how one guards the information that you're dealing with the parties. So we can get in courses now, we can get to a level of talking about things that we really couldn't get to when we designed the first courses, because there we were just trying to get people interested in the idea that, hey, this is possible to do. Now they come in assuming it's possible to do, and the question now is, how do I do it well? And so that's sort of a slightly different focus on designing. Does that make sense? Did I answer your question?
It certainly does. Yeah, no, I'm interested because I think about some of the work. I mean, there's a small naming confusion that used to happen when I was teaching in Singapore at Singapore Management University, SMU, and people would automatically assume that I was at Southern Methodist University. but still doing ODR stuff. And I found in trying to work with students in my dispute resolution course, asking them to use blogs as part of the teaching program was a resistance, because blogs is what you do in your free time. Blogs is not what you do for assessment. And the idea also of having professor reading your blogs and making part of grading was simply, it just did not compute. So there's, because so many of the people that you're now working with, you say that the world has changed. Everybody, not everybody, but the people you're dealing with are very much in an online world. So that's, there isn't a sales job to be done there. But the sales job may still be, how does this work in the other, my other life? It's not just my sitting down and looking at YouTube over a cup of coffee, but how do I actually use this technology in my work? So there's still a bit of a shift to be done, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. Yeah, and it's, you know, if you, when you have people who are immersed in a technology world, in an online world, a virtual world, personally, in their personal life, one of the things you have to put to sort of put the brakes on is to say, okay, you can't think about working with parties and their problems in the same way you think about, you know, Twitter and you know, whatever else.
Yeah.
Right? So it's it is shifting. It's saying, okay, it may be the same universe you're operating in, but you're operating in a different way. You have a different responsibility when you're operating in that universe. If you're dealing with, when people come to you with their problems, they're going to behave differently than they would have if they were trying to deal with these on their own. So, but just by the fact of being there, you're changing the dynamic and the way these people are dealing with the problem they've got. And so you have to be very careful about how you handle that situation, because, you know, for them, it's very important. And
sure.
I mean, you have an obligation to treat it seriously.
I mean, so going back to one of the points you made about, you know, using Ethan Katcher's fourth party, even before that, there's a third party, and your mere presence changes things. And I think what you're highlighting is that the very critical need to pay attention to the dynamics of what it is you're doing, whether it's merely as a third party without the technology or with the technology there. So, I mean, you, I'm getting a lot from your comments about the need to be attentive to the impact of the work you're doing, whether it's just you, Dan Rainey, or you plus technology. And I think there's a very vital lesson in that. I take you back a bit in your history, or you take us back a bit, and this might seem ancient history for some of the people who are out there potentially listening to this. You've worked with the National Mediation Board in the 1990s. Can you say a bit more about that?
Sure. What the board does is they handle dispute resolution for two sectors in the American economy, the airlines and railroads, commercial airlines and commercial railroads. It's a very specialized labor law.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you wind up doing is you wind up in the contract mediation, for example, if you could get the mediation completed in a year, that was considered success. And so you might meet, you know, for a week at a time every month for 12 months to get it done. You're dealing with very large sums of money. I mean, over $1 billion in every case.
Hmm.
And so, and you're dealing with at least five or six people on each side of the table. And so it's a very complicated, very sort of drawn out, sort of, it's very interesting work. And it also means that you're probably dealing with repeat players. It's a very interesting environment because, you know, basically the people who are at the table for the companies and the people who are at the table for the unions are very experienced. They probably know each other quite well. And so if you're sitting there as the third party between that, first of all, there's a huge amount of information that you have to have sort of at your disposal. We did a survey when I was there and ask the parties, you know, what's valuable about us? You know, why do you think we work with you? And what they said was, the main thing that we want from you is we want somebody at the table who knows what we're talking about. We want you to know our language. We want you to know our business, because frankly, from their point of view, if you're there and you can't help them get to a resolution, then why are you there? The whole notion of neutrality, I mean, they want you to tell them that they're crazy. They want you to tell them, you know, when they're making a mistake. They trust you, because they don't necessarily have to do what you tell them to do, but they trust you to be honest with them. And so what you need to do that is you need a ton of information about their specific case, about the trends in the industry. There's all that information that, you know, there are very few ways that you can get it. Some of it is historic, but a lot of it is just, you know, information that you need to have access to. So when I started working with them, the first thing we wanted to do was to be able to say, okay, you got your computer with you. And if there's a question about X, here's a pool of information you have at your disposal that you can get to at the table immediately. so that you can help the parties work through using that information. And that doesn't really sound like ODR to a lot of people, but basically what it does is it enables the third party to operate in a way that the parties wanted and respected, and help the mediator be successful. The other thing we did there is we began to do remote mediation. I mean, there was a mediator by the name of Mike Tosi who was doing work with Hawaiian Airlines. And he was also doing some other work in the U.S. And there was some urgency and he couldn't get to Hawaii. So he was on a laptop and they started referring to him as the virtual Tosi. They would carry him from room to room and they were doing caucuses on the laptop so that he could join them. That was unheard of just a year or so before we did that. And so what we tried to do was not, in an ODR sense, it wasn't radical. We were not trying to recreate PayPal or eBay at the board. What we were trying to do is say, look, there's some technology that will make you able to do things either easier or better, or things that you could not do that are directly enabling you to work better with the parties. And so that's what we were trying to do. And for a while it was pretty rudimentary stuff. When we first started working with this, in order to do web video, you had to actually go to a web video casting center. There was nothing on the market that would allow you to do what you and I are doing now, which is just a couple of laptops. Eventually that came along. But what we were trying to say is, like, what technology is there and how can we adapt that into the process that we're using here and the work that we're doing? So it was fun. I enjoyed it, put it that way.
I'm going to need to close in a couple of minutes just to keep this conversation within the normal bounds, but I could certainly go on forever because you've got an awful lot to offer here, Dan. But given your work within what I might even regard as kind of the ODR for regular folks, what two things? What are the opportunities in the next 5 years, opportunities and challenges?
Oh, wow. Well, I think the opportunities, in my mind, the opportunities are the ability to use the technology to open assisted dispute resolution to people who have not had the opportunity to avail themselves of it before. And that's, we go back to your issue of access. Mm-hmm. If people know that I'm there, and that I'm available and that it's easy to use. It just, as a very small example, I was talking to a colleague about why they've gone wholeheartedly into using online work for their arbitration. And he said, if you look at what we used to do, we had, we would have two or three people on each side of the table. We had to find a place to meet. We had to find a travel day on the front end, a travel day on the back end, and a day to work. So we had to find 3 days that about a dozen people had on their calendar that they could get to the place we were going to do the arbitration and then do the work. Now I got to find 2 hours. And so we can do double the work in half the time. And I think that's the opportunity. If people understand that they can offer these services to people who before would have had a problem getting there, with access would have been an issue. And I think there are some opportunities there to, we can call it access to justice or access to assistance or whatever you want to call it. Yep. I think the opportunity to open up the access is really there. The thing that I think is the danger, or the thing that I think is the problem, I've already talked about, and that is I think we're going to be seeing more and more sophisticated technology that will help us do our work. And I think we need to be paying very close attention to how that help is developed and how it is integrated into our practice. I strongly believe in using that. And I believe it's coming. I know it's coming, but I think we need to make sure that that we don't substantially change for the worse the work that we do by adopting technology that we don't completely understand or that we haven't really had control of on the front end.
Wow. That seems a couple of very important notes to close on, Dan. So we will do that. Dan, this has been fabulous. And again, haven't seen you in real life since our meeting in Paris in 2017. So it's great to have a chance to catch up again. And I really appreciate your contribution to this podcast series. This, particularly because this what's the word? Kind of normalizes ODR. And normalize the use of technology because it can be and is daunting for so many. So I really appreciate your the experience that you bring to this and the regularization of ODR, and I think the key warning notes about the ethical issues that we need to pay attention to. So thank you for your time, and thank you for locking yourself in a hotel room in Quebec City to do this. I very much appreciate your time.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I appreciate it. I really enjoyed it, and thanks a lot.
This podcast has been brought to you by ICODER, the International Council for Online Dispute Resolution. To learn more about ICODER or to become a supporting member, please visit our website at icodr.org.